Welcome back to our program, Past Impressions, designed to study the who, the whens, the whats of church history, but more importantly, to focus on the why it is so important. What difference does it make in our lives, and how are we different as we understand those people, places, events that shaped the history of the church? Whether you're a Latter-day Saint in the Salt Lake Valley or in the far stretches of Philippines or Panama, all of us have rich heritage because of our membership in the church. And Past Impressions is designed to examine those very dimensions that give us all a claim upon our pioneer ancestry and heritage in the church. I'm Brent Topp, professor of church history and doctrine and chair of that department at Brigham Young University. And joining with me today is my friend and colleague, Steve Harper, associate chair of church history and doctrine and professor at Brigham Young University. And Steve is one of the foremost experts on the first vision. And last time we talked about the historical setting, the prelude to the first vision. And today we're going to talk about the actual accounts of what took place in that sacred grove. Welcome, Steve. Glad to have you with us.
Thank you, Brian.
Well, Steve, the first vision is probably the most documented vision, or what we could call a theophany in history. Tell me what we know about that historical record and comment on the richness of the actual records themselves.
I'll be glad to do that. You know, for a historian like me, it is an absolute treasure trove. There are some really important events in history that are just so poorly documented or maybe weren't written down or told about for centuries after the fact. But with the first vision, we have a remarkably wonderful historical record. Like you said, I bet it's the best documented vision of God in history. Can you imagine if we had as much information about Isaiah's throne theophany, about Moses' receipt of the commandments? People would be thrilled about that. So let me tell you what the accounts that we have are. I'll just give you a rough sketch. The first one that Joseph wrote that we know of was it written in 1832? If he wrote one before that, we don't have it or don't know about it. But this was his first attempt to keep a history, as best we can tell. He started also keeping his revelations in record books. He started keeping his personal journal, and he started writing his history all at about the same time in 1832. And the first six pages of his letter book include that history, and that history begins with an account of the first vision. And this is the most raw of all the accounts. It's Joseph dumping his consciousness onto the page. It doesn't have hardly any punctuation in it. It's a little bit awkward, sometimes in phrasing, but it is my favorite of the accounts.
Why is that? You say it's raw, but why is it your favorite?
Well, because I think it gets me most close to the young Joseph. It's his best memory, as far as I can tell, of what it was like to be 14, or actually 12 to 15, as is what he describes in this account. So he tells us about his terrible problem of not being able to find the truth. And it's not just an intellectual problem. You know, I want to know who has the right doctrine. For him, it's a deeply spiritual problem. He's been listening to the revival preachers, and he says that he has become convicted of his sins. That's just exactly the vocabulary we would expect from somebody who'd been listening to these revival preachers.
So the focus is on his own spiritual salvation,
yes.
His own conversion.
Yes, and it's for those of us who've had similar experiences. I don't know if I've ever had it as intensely as he did, but I know what it feels like to be convicted of my sins and to desire forgiveness and to go in search of it. And because of Joseph Smith, I knew where to find it. But here's a young man who didn't know where to find it. He believed the Bible. He believed in Christ. He believed that salvation came through Christ. But which of all those churches, which soteriology, which doctrine of salvation would lead him to forgiveness of his sins? And every church he sampled taught him a different one. And when I read the accounts of Joseph's vision, the most literarily powerful theme is the terrible problem, the great anxiety, the distress, perplexed. It seems like he harvests his vocabulary to keep reminding me how awful it was to be convicted of his sins, to seek forgiveness and not be able to find it.
So very, very personal is this account.
It's very personal. It's beautiful. I hope everybody will read it and love it as much as I do and enjoy it. It was written both by Frederick Williams, who was Joseph's scribe and counselor at the time, and also by Joseph Smith. This is the only account that was written, at least in part, in Joseph Smith's handwriting. And so it is, to me, the most personal, the most intense. And I guess I resonate most with this one. It just speaks to my soul. I've been a 14-year-old boy convicted of sin and seeking forgiveness. I guess I can just identify with the Joseph Smith that this document describes.
Now, most Latter-day Saints, Steve, would probably only be familiar with the account that we have in Joseph Smith's history. So what other accounts, and why are there other accounts?
Excellent question. Each of them was created for particular circumstances. For example, this is Joseph's commanded on the day the church is organized to let there be a record kept. This is his effort to do that. He's trying to keep a history. I don't know for sure, but I think he probably in later years isn't very satisfied with this one. At least three different times in the 1830s, he starts to keep another history, and each time gets a little more elaborate, a little more sophisticated. He gets good help from the literary people around him. And so by the time he writes that one that we're most familiar with, I think that he thinks of that as his best product. Like we might write an essay for a college class, you know, we might put it through two or three versions before we're real satisfied with it. And since he was going to send that out to the world for publication as his history, his testimony, I think that he definitely got that one the most definitive, the most complete.
In fact, you mentioned the idea of papers. I'll bet you both of us have had experiences where we wrote things when we were a graduate student, and now years later, we would do it much better and we'd have a little different perspective, even though the core facts are the same. When we come back, we're going to talk about those different accounts and the purposes that they had. So wait for us after this break. We'll talk about additional accounts of the first vision.
If you missed the conversation with Elder Richard G. Scott and his daughter Linda, listen now to a few of his words.
I think just understanding the message of the restoration that's come through the prophet Joseph Smith, an evidence that there is a Father in heaven who loves us, a Savior who was willing to lay his life down for us, whose atonement has made it possible for us to resolve all of the difficult challenges in our life. When we have that overall understanding of our circumstance here on earth, it is not hard to exercise faith that in times of trial or challenge, we'll be supported by a loving Heavenly Father and aided by a Savior who is willing to lay his life down for our benefit.
For the rest of this and more, go to radio.lds.org. Conversations on the Mormon Channel.
Welcome back to Past Impressions. I'm Brent Topp, your host, and joining me today is an expert on the first vision of the prophet Joseph Smith, Professor Stephen Harper of the Department of Church History and Doctrine at Brigham Young University. In our last segment, we were talking about the prophet Joseph Smith's first account of this, written in 1832. And Steve, you told us how personal it was. Tell us about some of these other accounts that we have of Joseph's, what we call the first vision.
Well, two of them come in a relatively short span of time. They're in Joseph's journal for November 1835, the first one on the 9th of November. And this is when Joseph was visited by an eccentric fellow from the East who was claiming to have some pretty remarkable spiritual experiences of his own. And he asked Joseph Smith about his credentials, and Joseph told him about the coming forth of the Book of Mormon. And in that narrative, Joseph used the first vision as the first in a series of events that led to the revelation and translation of the Book of Mormon. A week later, Joseph reported the vision to a man named Erastus Holmes. though this account is barely a passing mention of the fact that a vision occurred. It's not a description of the vision itself. So you might sometimes hear people say, well, there are four accounts or five accounts that come to us from Joseph, and it depends on whether they're counting this one as an account of the vision or just a mention of it. The one folks know best is the one written as part of Joseph's formal history. And this is the one he started keeping in 1838 and into 1839. This is the one that we've excerpted in the Pearl of Great Price. It's by far the most full, the most complete, the most definitive. It's definitely the one to have in the canon, although I hope folks won't be bashful about reading the others as well. There's no problem reading the others. We can get a fuller, fleshed-out picture from that. Joseph first published the vision in what we sometimes call the Wentworth Letter. Mm-hmm. This is in 1842. A newspaper editor from Chicago, John Wentworth, wrote asking Joseph for source material for a friend of his who was writing a history of New Hampshire. And Joseph supplied that as best we can tell. We don't know what Wentworth did with it, if anything. Most of his papers were destroyed in the Chicago fire of 1871, but Joseph himself published the letter in the Times and Seasons newspaper in Nauvoo. So it was actually the first account published in North America. Joseph then, not long after that, published in the newspaper his 1838 account, the one that's in the Pearl of Great Price.
That's interesting. I think many members of the church probably are not familiar with these different accounts, and I think that's very fascinating to put it in the context. Now, I think there's something else that, Steve, I want you to comment on, and that is that there are others of Joseph's contemporaries that write about the first vision as well. Why don't you tell us about some of those things?
Well, there are probably there are four or five, depending on, again, on how we count them, accounts that came from people who lived at Joseph Smith's same time and who heard him tell of it or knew of it from his writings. So we might call these hearsay accounts or secondhand accounts.
Now, hearsay has kind of sometimes a negative connotation to it. What do you mean by hearsay there?
By that I mean they're not direct from Joseph. They come to us, they're a bit filtered. I don't mean to impeach them by any stretch, but I do want to urge just a bit of caution. You know, it's like running anything. It's, you know, the game we play where we whisper in someone's ear and around the circle. Well, this hasn't gone very far around the circle, but a little bit. So we can use these accounts, but I like to say that we should triangulate them. We should match them up against Joseph's. We should do all that we can to verify them and so on. We shouldn't. The word of wisdom says that tobacco should be used with judgment and skill. And I sometimes say that about these historical documents. They're to be used with judgment and skill. So we don't want to be used by them. We want to learn how to use them. The first of these that we want to talk about was written by Orson Pratt while he was on his mission in Scotland. He wrote it to publish to the world.
Missionary tract or something that he was going to use.
And, you know, this has been one of the most effective missionary tools throughout time, the testimony of the prophet Joseph Smith. And this is the first version of that, Orson Pratt's account. It is clearly dependent upon what Joseph wrote in his 1832 account. I'm not saying Orson had read that account, but he's clearly got the same story. Mm-hmm. And it's also the case that the 1842 Wentworth letter is very similar in some ways to Orson Pratt's account. I don't know whether Joseph actually used Orson Pratt's pamphlet to draft his Wentworth letter or if there was a source document behind the two of them. I don't know. Other folks seem more certain about that than I'm willing to be. But clearly Orson is getting his information from Joseph Smith, and there's a relationship between those accounts. This is a beautiful, beautiful document. Orson tells us some things we don't hear anywhere else, particularly about the brilliance of the light, the marvelous light that comes down from heaven. It's very, very beautifully written. Levi Richards, in 1843, heard Joseph give a discourse in Nauvoo, and he captured that in his journal. So that's another one. A newspaper reporter from Pennsylvania, a fellow named David White, came and interviewed Joseph Smith in Nauvoo, and then he reported that in the newspaper. And I've been quoted in the newspaper enough to know that one is – I wouldn't trust that one very far.
It's a little excerpted then.
Indeed. But I do trust it whenever I can, again, triangulate it. When I can find Joseph Smith saying the same thing directly two or three other places, then I feel pretty confident in it. But some of the details that David reports that are unique to him. I just can't be certain of them or not.
When we come back after our break, we will talk about these accounts and how they have been examined both critically and by members of the church through the years. And we will look at the impact of the different accounts of the first vision when we come back after this break.
We all have a legacy. It has always been there. And the things we do and the choices we make shape our future legacy. Click on radio.lds.org and download an episode of Legacy. Or listen to it live here on the Mormon Channel.
This is Brent Topp, and welcome back to our program, Past Impressions. With me today is Professor Steve Harper of the Department of Church History and Doctrine at Brigham Young University. We've been discussing the accounts of the first vision, Joseph Smith's own accounts that were written in 1832 and 35, the more official one that we have in 1838, 39, and also in 1842 in the Wentworth letter. Steve was also telling us about some of the hearsay accounts from some of the contemporaries of the prophet Joseph. Since those accounts, both from Joseph and from others, it has been the focus of a lot of attention, particularly from critics of the church that try to say that that is evidence that there couldn't have been a first vision because Joseph couldn't get his story straight the first time. Steve, what do we know about these arguments that people have used against the church because of multiple accounts?
You know, really, it boils down to three arguments. The first one was made by the Methodist minister. Joseph said he reported the vision to a minister who told him that it was of the devil and that those things don't happen and haven't happened since the days of the apostles. So there's that interpretation of religious history that simply rejects the possibility that it could have happened. And I find, frankly, that all of the critics of the vision begin with that assumption. It could not have happened. Mm-hmm. So they've already decided the conclusion. They therefore need a refutation of Joseph's accounts. And Fawn Brody has probably been one of the most effective of those who have argued against Joseph's vision. She wrote in the middle of the 20th century a biography of Joseph, and she was a gifted writer. And so she wrote this line that the first vision was a half-remembered dream. And, you know, if you're not very critical of it, if you don't examine the documents yourself and study the history, then you can be pretty satisfied with that, especially if you've decided yourself that the vision couldn't have happened and so you need some alternative explanation. Then it's just poetic almost, a half-remembered dream. She said, too, that Joseph, you know, she said, we don't have any documents. He didn't come right home and write it in his planner or put it in his notebook. And so he didn't write it down for at least a dozen years, as best we can tell. So she said that he concocted it when a need arose. And then she said, too, that it was sheer invention. So these are some of her phrases. Now, one problem that she encountered is that more and more accounts arose. See, we didn't know about that wonderful 1832 account until 1965 when Paul Cheesman published it in his master's thesis. The church historians had kept it and brought it across the plains, but it had sort of lain dormant in the church archives until somebody did some research and looked at it. So that was discovered and published. Dean Jesse discovered an 1835 account. So you start to get these accounts that come closer to the actual event, and Fawn Brody has to account for these. Mm-hmm. When she writes her second edition of Joseph's biography, she doesn't reexamine her thesis that Joseph invents it when he needs it. She just moves her date back. She just changes one number in her book. So she's already decided what can possibly
don't
be.
Don't confuse me with the facts be. Type
right.
thing.
Right. Okay. Yeah, I think it's really a case of that. And then, you know, the other main argument that is made was first voiced by Reverend Wesley Walters, a Presbyterian minister. And his critique was essentially that Joseph was not consistent with historical facts. That is, Walter said, there is no evidence of revivalism in Palmyra Village at the time Joseph says there is, and so his claim to have been influenced by that revivalism to go to the woods to pray can't possibly be true. And that's an interesting argument itself, too. One of the things it does is puts a little bit of words in Joseph's mouth and then disproves them. Joseph doesn't claim revivalism in Palmyra Town. Mm-hmm. He says it's the whole district of country. He locates the revivalism around Manchester, New York, not Palmyra. I find Latter-day Saints misunderstand that all the mm-hmm. time. I hear Palmyra, Palmyra, Palmyra. He doesn't live in Palmyra. He's in Manchester, and he uses a Methodist term, district. The whole district of country seemed affected by it. Joseph knows exactly what that word means. A Methodist district is like a Catholic diocese or an LDS stake. And when Professor Backman started to examine the Reverend Walter's claims and started to look and see if there was any evidence, it turns out there is ample boatloads of evidence of revivalism upstate New York, exactly when and exactly where Joseph says there is. I won't take time today to tell you about all of it, but my very own eyes earlier this year were looking at the journals of the Reverend Benaha Williams, and he's documenting revivals in Joseph's neighborhood at exactly the right time and exactly the right place. He's got the Reverend George Lane, which Joseph Smith's younger brother William said was there. Benaha Williams has got him there, and he even tells us the text of his sermon. So Joseph's story absolutely corroborates with the historical facts. There's no doubt about that.
So it seems like what you're saying is that the criticisms that come over and over and over again, that they feel like they've really got the hook, that we have now killed Mormonism because these accounts show that Joseph couldn't get his story straight. But in reality, the more we study the documents and more we study the records, the more it holds up and the more it substantiates the very claims that the prophet Joseph has said.
That is certainly the case for me. The more I study his documents, the more confirming they are to me. The more I study the historical environment, the more Joseph's experience matches it. If he didn't claim to have a vision of God and Christ, or if that vision didn't lead him to establish the restored Church of Christ, nobody, no historian at all, would find any fault with his accounts because they so perfectly represent the time and place in which he lived. There were other people in the woods. Mm-hmm. Charles Finney famously is in the woods in Adams
praying.
County,
mm-hmm.
receiving a vision even.
Right. Yep.
And yet the difference is his vision doesn't have the same theological content as Joseph's. And so nobody makes a big deal of that. Finney is considered one of the foremost Protestant revivalists in American culture.
Interesting. When we come back, we're going to talk more about the impact that these various accounts of the first vision have on us today and their significance.
Who we are is one of life's greatest questions. As members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, it has been revealed who we are. Go to radio.lds.org and download an episode of Mormon Identity and listen to Who We Are on the Mormon Channel.
Welcome back to Past Impressions. I'm joined by Professor Steve Harper from the Department of Church History and Doctrine at Brigham Young University, and I'm Brent Topp, the host of this program. We've been talking about the various historical accounts of the first vision, and in the last segment, Steve, we talked about how critics of the church have tried to dismiss or discount the reality of the first vision because there are differing accounts. And I find that fascinating since the New Testament has a very similar type history and different accounts. The Gospels themselves are testimonies or witnesses of the resurrection of Christ, told from different perspectives at different times to different audiences. I also find it interesting that the Apostle Paul himself gives a variant account of his vision of the Savior on the road to Damascus, depending upon where he is speaking and to whom he is speaking. And yet no one seems to criticize the reality of the New Testament based on those variant transmissions of Jesus' resurrection accounts or Paul's great conversion accounts.
That's really true, Brent. You know, a historian would be much more troubled if we kept getting absolute mirror images of these accounts from Joseph over time. if he's saying the same thing to everybody everywhere at the same time. And especially, he may be saying awfully close to the same thing, but the way it gets remembered and recorded and transmitted down to us, that accounts for a lot of the variation. You know, I've become convinced that folks who seem disconcerted when they learn that there are a variety of accounts, I'm convinced that it's the newness of it that's disconcerting. It's something they hadn't known before. The reason for that is because my mentors, Richard Bushman, Milton Bachman, Richard Anderson, Larry Porter, these great historians, they've studied these for half a century. Dean Jesse, you know, discovers them. He publishes them. These guys aren't disconcerted by them. They believe, they know these accounts inside out. They could quote them to us in many instances. So the people who know them best believe them. I know them. I've held the manuscripts in my hands. And I think, though, that it's people who've thought a little bit more about history or about how memory works. They're not disconcerted when we see this variety of accounts. We expect them to sound like Paul or like the Gospel.
So don't you think, though, that there are some people that might think, well, what else have they been hiding from me or whatever? And it's just not the nature to be able to. I always joke with my students, I actually know more than it appears.
Yeah.
I know more than I can actually teach in a 50-minute class period.
I asked Dean Jesse about that. I said, you know, what would you say to people who feel like, you know, they've been sort of bamboozled? Like, you know, why hasn't the church told me about these accounts? And he gave his wry smile, and in his understated way, he said, I think they'd be okay if they were a little more inclined to read. These accounts have been published repeatedly.
Exactly. So it's really nothing new. It's new to the person.
It is. And the church has publicized them and published them. They were just republished recently in a book called Opening the Heavens. They're in the Joseph Smith Papers. You know, I talk about them every chance I get, but I guess I'm not very influential.
So I don't think it's a threat to their faith. It shouldn't be anyway. It's just the newness and that we're not as inclined to read all of the history and everything that's been published in the Ensign or anywhere else.
Indeed.
What would you say are the weaknesses or the challenges of memory in as we then have to record and we record after the fact? I don't go right home and write my journal or if I'm writing my life history now, I'm looking back over a half a century as opposed to just recording what significant event happened last night.
I think memory is one of the most misunderstood things that there is. We make a lot of assumptions about memory. But even if we just think a little bit about our own memories, we know our assumptions are wrong. We have something called episodic memory. This is the ability to remember things from the past. When we see something, we initially memorize massive amounts of data. We just drink it in. But we do not have the capacity to remember that for more than a few seconds. When we have a memorable experience, we focus on it and we forget everything but a few details, the details that capture our attention. When next time you read Joseph's accounts, notice that that's exactly the way he represents the memory of it. It's also true that we have what scholars sometimes call interpretive memory. Memories are a mixture of past and present. We give meaning to our memories. Memories are not freestanding, carrying their own meaning with them. We decide what they mean. We decide how to make sense out of our past. And so it's a perfectly legitimate thing for Joseph Smith to do that, the same as I do or anybody else does. It's also true that we fill in gaps in our episodic memory with things we know from our semantic memory. So we all have this tendency to, when we can't quite remember how something happened, unconsciously we fill in what we think should have happened based on other experiences we know about.
Mm-hmm. Today we've been talking about the various accounts of the first vision, the criticisms of them, the strengths of them, the different facets, like a facets of a diamond that we learn about it. The accounts have given us a lot of perspective. Next time on Past Impressions, we will talk about what happens when Joseph walks out of that sacred grove? How the world is different. So join us next time on Past Impressions when we talk about the theological significance of the first vision.